Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the second day of April, Anno Domini 2022, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, we are going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get blues. Here comes the news.
All right, which one are we doing first?
I just got to remember, though, to look at this clock.
Yeah.
And not that one.
Yeah, right.
After so many years, you get in the habit, you know, of looking at one particular one, and then it's like, oh, now I got to look down here. That one was never right, and now it is. Technical information, folks.
That's right. We'll
behind the scenes.
We'll cut all this out in post.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. All right, I'm trying to start the studio.
All right, I could do a news item here.
All right, no, I got it.
Okay, go ahead. FCC?
Yeah, the security firm Kaspersky Lab has been identified as a national security threat by the Federal Communications Commission, the first time a Russian company has been included on the regulator's covered list. The covered list contains companies and organizations that the FCC deems, and I quote, pose an unacceptable risk to U.S. national security, end quote. Kaspersky joins China Mobile and China Telecom as new additions to the list. Others on the list are ZTE and Huawei. The whole list really only has eight entities on it right now, so you can tell they're serious.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Under the list's rules, companies in the U.S. are not allowed to use any subsidiaries obtained through the FCC's Universal Service Fund to acquire any products or services from list organizations. The fund largely assists the deployment of telecoms in underserved areas with low incomes and high associated costs, which limits the scope of the list's impact on listed companies. In response, Kaspersky said it was disappointed with the decision. Quote, This decision is not based on any technical assessment of Kaspersky's products that the company continually advocates for, but instead is being made on political grounds, Kaspersky said.
Very well.
Continue to assure its partners and customers on the quality and integrity of its products and remains ready to cooperate with the U.S. government agencies to address the FCC's and any other regulatory agencies' concerns. I sincerely apologize to anyone from Eastern Europe for my muddle European accent.
No, that was pretty darn good.
Well, to your ears, maybe. The inclusion on the list is not the toughest restriction the U.S. government nor its agencies has applied against Kaspersky. In 2017, a presidential order banned the use of Kaspersky Lab products within the U.S. government and its agencies. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is FCC calls Russian Kaspersky Lab a national security risk. And your choices are, I'm using it anyway. I'll stop using it right now. I don't use it. And other. And I don't know how many things we have so far because my machine is a little screwed up.
I'm not sure what the FCC... Did the FCC cite any specific reason why they chose to add them to the list?
Because they're Russian, as far as I can tell.
Because Kaspersky says it's political, and I look back to the FCC and say, all right, so what is the deal? How does one get on this list? They say it's an unacceptable risk. I guess if you've got a security vendor and the source code isn't... something you can inspect yourself, you don't really know what's in it or what it's doing precisely.
Well, it's not open source, and the company is based in Russia, and it sends data back to its servers, which any legitimate antivirus program will do.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's normal.
Yep.
But you don't know what those data are.
And what they're doing with it. That's
right.
That's the other big underlying thing, because they're so secretive that they could be used in it for other things. And right now, the way the Russians passed attacks on people's or corporate systems and everything else, they've got a very fine line of being able to be trusted.
Hmm.
You know, because they've committed so many cyber attacks that we know of that have, you know, taken over and held for ransomware different corporations and like the gas line. You know, that was one big one, and that was in a Russian, that was proven to be a Russian attack. So credibility isn't there for them right now. And they're sort of thrown into this big bucket.
Right.
Because they're from Russia, then they don't trust it. And it's just the way things are right now.
Now, the rules are that if you get money from the FCC Universal Service Fund, then you're not allowed to use those dollars to acquire these this particular tool. But any other person who chooses to use it still could, you know.
Exactly
so,
right.
So and, this mm-hmm. is really just a level of control that the government has over its own spending and not anyone else's.
Right. This is something that the government has decided to do in and of itself,
right.
And it can serve as a recommendation to others, but isn't nobody is saying no American can use Kaspersky.
It would also be interesting to know how much of the Universal Service Fund previous to this was actually being used with this particular product.
Right. And how, you know, how widespread it is.
Right.
Right. That one of the issues, you know, you feel kind of if in fact they are innocent, you got to feel bad for Eugene Kaspersky and his people, because they went to the point of moving their corporate headquarters to Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get a whole lot more
neutral
than that.
Right.
And their servers are in Ireland. So theoretically.
Other than the name
and where it was originally incorporated.
Sure.
And the fact that the company started in Russia. You know, when you send data, when Kaspersky sends data to its servers, they're in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily yeah. mean they aren't going somewhere else from there, or there isn't some hook into that.
Sure.
But, you know, theoretically, he's doing good stuff. But the fact is, when you use a closed source product, you're trusting someone else. And the government has decided that it, in itself as an entity, does not wish to trust mm-hmm. Kaspersky.
Right.
Yep. Like you say, they're all thrown into this
That's
one bucket. And unfortunately, well, it's no different in people's thinking of Corona, the coronavirus.
Right.
What happened? Corona beer suffered. Had
right.
no link to it whatsoever, but right. all of a sudden sales for them went right down the toilet.
Name association.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, you hear that Russian name and you think, oh, terrorists and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Unfortunately.
Like, well,
wait till I tell you about your kids. They might be learning something called algebra. In
using Arabic numerals,
oh,
mister.
Oh,
what are
exactly
we
right.
do?
Algebra. yeah. Well, I do want to say for everybody listening, I can't seem to get the StreamYard started, and that's entirely.
We'll hit it during the break.
Entirely on me. Maybe I'll try again during the break, but right now I cannot get it started. So.
What else is going on in the news?
That's the big number one thing, and
okay.
we do have 30 votes so far in the poll. I'd like to see people vote. We actually hit 50 at one point.
What's the top so far?
I don't use it.
Okay.
26 of you.
But now we know.
It's still one of the choices in the security tango, and I left it there because we don't know. So you have the right, because
sure.
this is America,
mm-hmm.
use that software if you want. I tend to use as much open source software as I possibly can. So I'm using ClamAV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to use it and you trust the Kaspersky people, then you should use it. You know, we're not going to tell you no.
Right.
That's your choice.
And I will say, for decades, they've had a good reputation.
They've had a great reputation.
So.
They're always among the top of the, you know, when everybody does a test of antivirus programs, they always come out near the top.
That's true.
And so, you know, that the thing does good work and that the people are doing good job behind it, but.
So, yeah. evaluate the situation for yourself.
Right, right.
That's one thing I've been trying to do right now as I slowly get into Linux.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Is trying to find the other software that, you know, that I use that will work within Linux.
Right.
And, you know, granted, there's over 70,000 packages that, you know, you can get into and all that. But quite often I'm finding that I have to go to the particular website, and they've got instructions that if you're installing it on Debian or Linux and that, you know, you got to do this, this, and this. No big deal. It's not as simple right. as, say, sometimes as Windows, where you can just sit there and say, install, although a lot of them are.
Mm-hmm. Many of them are. And if you go to alternative2.net,
yes.
you can type in, for example, Photoshop
mm-hmm.
and see alternatives to that. And before, and much as I look forward to your calls and letters, before you all call in and tell me, I'm a professional photographer and it does none of those things, I get it. But for most people, for like 95% of people.
The average
yes. user.
We keep them in a bell jar. They're right here in the studio.
That's right. And we weigh them against your needs. But the general use case of Photoshop is such that you can easily replace it with a free program called the GIMP, the GNU Image Manipulation Program. And the GIMP is free. It is open source. It is available on dang near every Linux distribution, or you can just download it for Windows or the Mac.
I saw a version as I was setting it up, ZBrush. Remember that?
Oh, yes.
They've got that on Linux, and it's like, whoa.
Yep. ZBrush is another good product.
You know, and they have another one, you know, one like it. Same type of layouts and everything else. And what that ZBrush is, folks, is more or less a modeling program.
Okay.
And you can sit there and model stuff, and it's like, if you had a huge hunk of clay and start pulling and shaping it and creating things and all that. Back in the day on Second Life, there was a lot of artists out there that used ZBrush for creating different characters or different things.
Right, because you could then export them.
Yeah, and then, you know, you could apply textures to them and everything else, and it's a real cool tool, and it was quite an expensive software package at the time, too, like $500.
It says it's been around for a long time, since 99.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And oh, yeah.
It's available for Windows and Mac.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we had a lot of fun with that. But, yeah, right now, like I say, I've been discovering there's so many out there, programs out there in that hopefully my goal is...
Okay.
By fall, I want to get off of Windows totally and be on Linux.
Okay.
And I'm playing with the Twister OS. Right now, Twister OS for the Raspberry Pi is still 32-bit. But they are moving full guns forward to get to the 64. Matter of fact, the guy that I refer to quite often, Ellie Leap, SP Videos. He just did a beta one version of putting Windows 64-bit Twister on. And it's not ready yet, but I'd say by summer it's going to be out there. Because right now you can go to the Twister OS site, and if you hear us say, well, use that old PC. Well, you can literally go to the Twister OS PC and get what they call the Twister UI. And basically, this one gentleman, Eat My Pie, Bite My Pie. I say that.
All right, so you get the Twister UI, then what happens?
If you get BYTE, Bite My Pie, he gives you the instructions how it's got to be put on a Linux base system. So you could load Linux any flavor you want down to your PC. From there, he then gives you the instructions how to load the Twister OS UI on it. And then, because he says it's like a hamburger.
Yep.
You just can't have one layer. This is like a hamburger. You just can't pull the buns out. You got to have the Linux base, and then Windows sits on top of it, the meat.
the UI, the graphical user interface.
Sure. Yeah.
I once, like I said, when I first started out with Windows, I had about 30 UIs loaded in. And there's a menu you can just pick them from. And I used to change them every day trying to find one I really liked before I finally settled on XFCE. But as I was saying, I had, by the way, you folks can give us a call. I don't know why you're waiting. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
Our listeners are very polite. They're very polite, but
feel free to give us a call.
Yeah, we're just killing time. Well,
the front door is open.
The calls.
The cookies are warm. Come on over.
Come on over. I used KDE a while, but it was very, at the time, 20 plus years ago, horribly, horribly slow. And people have been telling me it's been getting faster and faster. But I saw one of those Leap SP videos, or Leap PS, whatever they are, videos, and they, it's fast.
Yeah.
It's not only pretty, it's always been pretty. Now it's fast. And I kind of like that. I may have to try that. Because we were talking about this, too. I have a Raspberry Pi 400, and now so does
Dave.
Now
they're like,
and you can just change the hard drive.
Uh-huh.
Right? So either as an SD card or plug in a hard drive.
Yes.
Because you can now boot from the hard drive.
Now, is that a new feature?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
You just go into the imager. You go down to miscellaneous, and they have a boot feature. And you can either, you know, you can switch it back and forth. Because what happens is you just put an SD card in, and you tell it, all right, I want to boot from an SSD hard drive. You put it in, flash it to it, take it the card out, put it into your Pi. Your Pi will boot up for a second, turn to a green screen. You wait 10 seconds, shut it off, then hook up your hard drive. It will then not look at for the micro SD card. It then looks for the USB port, the USB 3, and boots off that hard drive.
So
you have to
like
set up the
BIOS
hard drive first.
Okay, you get like a BIOS ability to pick the boot.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's got to be in order.
That's what it's doing. And you can always reverse it. So if you want to go back to SSD cards, which I don't know why you'd want to, because that can slow things down.
They're convenient and cheap, and you might have a dozen of them.
Yeah.
And if you're only playing, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, true.
You know, I've got a bunch of 64 meg SSDs, micro SD cards, and why not use them?
Right.
If all I'm doing is playing.
That's what I've been doing.
Yeah, as long as all I'm doing is playing. If it's a production machine, you set it up to boot off a real hard drive and you work with it. But if you're only playing, it doesn't much matter.
Well, that's like I was telling you. I wound up collecting so many hard drives, laptop hard drives, out of machines that were getting rid of. They were dead, but the hard drive was still good, the screen or keyboards, whatever. So I pulled the hard drives out, and I had a nice little stack of them.
Yep.
So right now, that little stack is turning into a different operating system. I'm putting a Post-it note on it, writing. Oh, yeah, this has got Linux Mint versus the OS, Twister OS. I've been trying a few others. That one that I sent you, which is he's talking about, is Bullseye. It's just another version of Twist.
No, the way that works is Debian has always named its distributions after Toy Story characters.
Okay.
So there was Woody and, you know, all the Buzz and all the characters. The one I've been using on my Raspberry Pi 4 is Buster, which is the one before. Well, I think Buster is the dog.
Yes.
I think he's the slinky dog.
Bullseye then?
Bullseye is the horse.
The horse.
Oh, okay.
So, Woody's horse.
Cool. What?
Woody's horse.
Woody's horse.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, Jesse's horse.
Sorry.
When you get down to it. So basically, and there was a Jesse and their beta version, which crashes all the time, is Sid, who was the evil kid in the first one. Which is very clever. Anyway, the idea is that I'm using Buster and I haven't upgraded to Bullseye yet, but it's all 64 bit.
Yeah.
And the one you've got, and then you can put any front end you want on it, like you're doing with Twister.
Yeah.
You could put KDE on that. You could put anything you want on it.
The themes versus and plus the wallpaper selection. I was going wild with, you know, cause you can go to the one tab and say, get more, background wallpapers.
Yep.
And the list just kept going. and going and going and going. So you can copy them, put them into a folder of, say, wallpapers, and then you can have it rotate through, you know, say, every 10 minutes, grab a different wallpaper, like Windows does.
Yeah. If you're an XFCE user, you'll want to go to XFCE-look.org. And okay. it showed what?
Yeah, XFCE. You XFCE. Said dash look?
Dash look.
Okay.
XFCE-look.org. And it'll show you all kinds of XFCE stuff. And there's another one whose name I can't remember that lists themes for all kinds of places.
Well, while we talk about that, we are getting the StreamYard link set up, which means we'll be streaming live to YouTube and possibly elsewhere, but we'll get that figured out. We've also got a call coming up here.
Yep, we've got a call from Bill from Greece, New York. Hiya, Bill, what's up?
Hi, guys. You do a great job. We're very grateful for what you do.
Thank you.
And about Linux, you keep equating Photoshop with GIMP.
I already said it's not for professionals.
But GIMP, professional photographers don't shoot in what they call JPEG. They use the RAW version, which is all the data, and GIMP right. doesn't touch RAW.
Right.
But you do have many alternatives in Linux. The one I like best is Darktable.
Darktable.
Darktable is actually more involved than the Photoshop. You can do more things in Darktable. So if you want to tell people about Linux and equate it to Photoshop, tell them to try Darktable. It's quite a bit better. It does the RAW for you.
That's good to know.
Excellent. Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, there's always something good.
Well, that's
always something to learn.
Yeah, well, that's the thing of this. It's being open source is so wide open. And it's, you know, open codes. Anybody can write an application for it.
And the right. discovery of it is the, half the fun.
Oh, tell me about it.
Yeah, right. And there's also an XFCE look. There's a KDE look, KDE-look.org and yep. GNOME-look.org and XFCE-look.org. And you can download hundreds and hundreds of themes and emoticons and icon packs and different mouse cursors. And
so customization yeah. is one of the key elements.
Oh, that is they give yeah. you full control.
When you're using a Mac, you're using what they give you.
You're using decisions that somebody else made.
Right, yep. And the same with Windows.
Yeah.
They decided what the look of you can change the colors.
Yeah, you can yeah. mildly.
But with this, you can change everything.
Right. Which is great, as long as you, if that's exciting to you.
Right.
If that's something you need.
Well, you can find the thing you like, which is the best part.
Right.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Dennis Worster, which thank you again for coming in today. Steve Ray, one step ahead of the law somewhere in the Southwest, but Dennis has jumped into the gap to save us all, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites. It's 29 minutes after the hour. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And online, we have Steve Ray. Do you want to be...
This just in.
Here he is. He's here. If you can see him online. Steve was kind enough to fix my screw-ups. Apparently, I really don't know how to use StreamYard at all. Also, Nick, I couldn't get to the...
Nick, you should go find somebody who's good at computers.
Because it ain't me. I couldn't get to Facebook, and it stalled everything.
Okay.
Because I don't know why I can't get to Facebook with this machine, but I couldn't. And consequently, it stalled everything. But Steve was kind enough to take time out from being one step ahead of the law somewhere in the Southwest to put us all on live. So we're live on YouTube, and I think, are we also live on, just YouTube.
Well, that's a heck of a start.
YouTube is where you'll find us if you're on YouTube.
That's right.
Otherwise, we're here on StreamYard, we're here on live on the air, and we're streaming at jazz901.org, and I believe it's time for another news item. Well, you give us a call at 585-9660. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. On Thursday, Apple released fixes for two critical zero-day vulnerabilities in iPhones, iPads, and Macs that give hackers dangerous access to the internals of the OSs the device runs on. Mm-hmm. Apple credited an anonymous researcher with discovering both vulnerabilities. The first vulnerability resides in Mac OS for Monterey, which is probably not the way you say that. And in iOS or iPad OS for most iPhone and iPad models. The flaw, which stems from an out-of-bounds write issue, as so many do, gives hackers the ability to execute malicious code that runs in with privileges of the kernel, the most security-sensitive region of the OS. The other vulnerability, meanwhile, also results from an out-of-bounds read issue that can lead to the disclosure of kernel memory. Apple disclosed only bare-bones details for the flaws. Apple is aware of a report that this issue may have been actively exploited, they wrote of both vulnerabilities. These are the fourth and fifth 0 days Apple has patched this year. In January, the company rushed out patches for iOS, iPadOS, macOS, Monterey, watchOS, tvOS, and HomePod software to fix a zero-day memory corruption flaw that could give exploiters the ability to execute code with kernel privileges. The bug resided in the IO mobile frame buffer. Mm-hmm. A separate vulnerability made it possible for websites to track sensitive user information. The exploit code for that vulnerability was released publicly prior to the patch being issued. That's bad. Apple in February pushed out a fix for a use after free bug that in the WebKit browser engine, use after free is one of the most common bugs that gave attackers the ability to run malicious code on iPhones, iPads, and iPod Touches. Apple said, are they still making iPod Touches?
Do you call it iPod Touches or iPods Touch?
Oh, very good question. Like attorneys general.
Attorneys general, yes.
Okay. Apple said that Apple said that reports it received indicated the vulnerability might have been already actively exploited as well. A spreadsheet Google research security researchers maintained to track 0 days shows Apple fixed a total of 12 such vulnerabilities in 2021. Among those is a flaw in iMessenger that the Pegasus spyware framework was targeting using a zero-click exploit, meaning devices were infected merely by receiving a malicious message without any user interaction required.
That's capital B bad.
That's capital B bad. Capital B-A-D bad.
Right.
2 0-days that Apple patched in May made it possible for attackers to infect fully up-to-date devices. So are your Apple devices up-to-date? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
Apple's got a checkbox that they allow you to set on nearly all of their devices that says, keep my device up-to-date. And what that means is the device phones home periodically, says, hey, are there any updates for me? And I think in general it does this once a week, but I think you can tweak things to make it happen more often.
You can do it by hand every hour if you want to.
Sure. You can manually hit the button and say, how about now?
That's one thing I couldn't believe about Linux. I'm working away, setting stuff up.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I hear, ding.
Yep.
And this window opens up down the corner and says, hey, you got some updates you should do. You want to do them now?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Windows doesn't do that for me.
Right. So it'll do them for you. And unless it's a kernel change, you don't reboot.
Yeah.
Which for Windows people is a shock. For Mac people, it's like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I had this big screen and, you know, I hear the ding and I'm looking all over and I go down to the corner.
Which
and here's this little window.
Yeah. Because that's not going to interrupt you. Your machine won't stop running.
No.
And nothing bad will happen.
No. Method gave you the option whether you want to do it now or delay it an hour or whatever.
Right. Yeah, right.
But it does take a little while when you've got, you know, a watch and you've got two Apple TVs at home and a handful of miscellaneous machines and suddenly you realize, oh, I've got updates. Okay, well, I'll I make sure that the box is checked, but still, you know, because I'm paranoid, I just go through and wander around the house, clicking,
yep,
do it, and then they're all done. But right. When you hear about updates, suddenly it's like, oh, okay, I've got some work to do, and to tell the wife and the kids to do all their phones, and
yep.
There's a lot to keep track of.
Yep. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Pat from Batavia, New York. Hiya, Pat. What's up?
Well, Nick and the guys got an issue that came up. My wife and I had some extra money from taxes, and she said, go out and buy yourself a new computer.
God bless her.
So I ran, yeah.
Yeah, before she changes her mind, right?
Absolutely, you got that. And so first thing I remember is Nick said, you get more power per dollar for a desktop, so I did that.
Okay.
And I think Dave said LibreOffice is a good program to install.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis said, I hope someday I'm as old as Nick and Dave. I want to include everybody there.
If I can live that long, that'll be wonderful.
There you go, brother. Okay, now, I'm going to switch hands because here's the problem.
Okay.
I downloaded the LibreOffice install program. It says type as Windows installer. I double click on it, and I'm doing this in real time. And I get a message that pops up and says, this installation package could not be opened. Verify the package exists and that you can access it or contact the application vendor, blah, blah, blah. So. Hmm.
Sounds like a bad download.
Wait a minute. When you were downloading, did you get a message that says keep
or run?
Or there's a like a blue window that opens up, and you got to click on it and say more, and it'll say, yeah, keep it anyways, because Windows tries to block stuff.
Especially installers.
Yeah, especially if it thinks something isn't right as far as being an installer.
Okay, I'm not going to pretend I could answer that question.
Okay.
Because it was yesterday.
So all right,
What I was going to say or ask is, I also took your advice to put the Revo in.
Mm-hmm.
Usually I would think about that 3 years into owning the computer. This time I did it right at the beginning.
Good job.
Again, you guys told us to do that, and then I listened to about 10% of what you say. And
hey, that's twice as much as people
I'm going to do backup someday, too.
All right.
We'll get you there.
Well, in between that, we got to get you using a password manager.
I'm going to do that, too. You want to see my red notebook? Okay. Seriously, should I just delete this program and reinstall, or should I use a Revo, or what was
it? It didn't install.
Right.
Because you got that error message, all you have to do is delete the installer file you downloaded.
Yep.
Okay.
Now, when you go to download it again, you have six choices. One of which is Windows 32-bit, and the other of which is Windows 64-bit.
Okay, let me just go back to the LibreOffice. First of all, it is LibreOffice.org.
Yep, LibreOffice.org. Right.
Yeah. Okay, so I had the option to do LibreOffice 7.3.2.
That's the one.
If you're an early adopter, and I'm not an early adopter. I'm still thinking about a password manager, so I'm not early adopter. So 7.2.6.
Right.
And you're right, it's a 64 version or all the other ones.
Right.
And I picked the 64.
Okay.
Excellent and I'm going to do it again because I've got a high-speed internet here.
Right. What sometimes happens is that things come down badly, frankly.
I'll save here. And it says your download will begin shortly.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're doing this, I've got another quick question. Greenlight.
Mm-hmm.
Does it really have the same 150 or 300, whatever it is, the same upload as download?
It is symmetrical. They say on their site it is symmetrical. Now, nothing is 100% symmetrical.
Yeah. Oh, no. I understand that. But, I mean, I've got a high-speed internet. It's supposed to be a gigabyte. I don't get over 500 or 600, but it's only 50 upload, which is still, anybody that's plugging along at 2 megabytes is going to say, what are you complaining about, 50?
Yeah, right.
Anyway, that's done. So it says show all. Okay, it's still downloading, so I've got another 42 seconds.
Yeah, but yes, Greenlight is symmetrical, as they advertise on their website. Mm-hmm. Again, I get slightly less upload than I do download.
But way more than 50.
Way more than 50 and very close to what I'm paying for. So, you know, I don't complain. The other thing is, where are you testing? I did just the other day, just because I was apparently bored, I did a test to 5 different locations.
Okay.
I got 5 different responses.
Oh, yeah. Depending on the traffic and hardware.
Yeah, he was in his house. Yep, he's got green light service.
Yeah, I have green light at home.
So you walked all around your house to see?
No. I was just sitting at my desk, plugged right into the router. I used 5 different sites on the web. You go to speedtest.net, I think it is, and you can pick your server.
Yeah.
So I picked U of R, I picked RIT, I picked the one in Syracuse, I picked another one somewhere else. And I checked 5 different sites. Uh-huh. And they were all different speeds.
Oh, well. Okay, I know your listeners are sitting there with bathed breath and they're wondering how this is going to work out.
Yes, drum roll.
So I double left click, right? Correct?
Yep,
right.
Get that rolling.
And it says the same thing. This installation package could not be opened.
Hmm. Did you click twice?
Yeah.
On the little thing at the bottom right?
No, I clicked. I'm in the Windows folders.
Wait a minute. When you clicked the download, did it give you any kind of message?
It popped up. No, I didn't see a message. So maybe what I need to do in order to get all of this, and I won't do this on air, but it just does this make any sense to you, that I shut everything down, restart the computer, delete this first of all, and then start all over again in case a message would only come up once?
You could, but sometimes, though, up in the upper right-hand corner of your browser, you can get a warning that you're trying to download something and Windows is blocking it.
I will, upper right-hand corner, you said, right?
Yeah, you can get warnings in your browser that, you know, Windows, it's got a tagline across it saying, you know, Windows prevented, is unsure about this install, you sure you want to do this?
No, I just did it again, and it seems to be coming right up.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it's possible that there was a message, and I just ignored it. So I think what I'll do is I'll just shut everything down, and I'll call you back next week and tell you if it worked.
All right, and if that doesn't work, what you can do, your wife has a computer?
Oh, I got all around the house. I got LibreOffice on the computer upstairs.
Well,
know what? Maybe you're not running it as administrator.
Could be.
This is a new one, I think. Okay.
Right click on it. Right click on the
installer.
The installer and say run as administrator.
That's a good point. I'm going to download it again. And like I said, I'm not going to keep you online for that. But I will next time. Run it as administrator, right?
Yep.
That's the way to do it.
Okay, I'll try that. If that doesn't work, I'll restart the computer. I'll jump up and down and swear at you guys. And
Installed. Now, can you see the files on your wife's machine?
No, hers is another room.
And so you don't share files between each other?
No, she's got a whole different...
All right, well, what you could do, though, is download it on her machine, put it to a flash drive, bring it over to yours, plug it in, and...
Yeah, but I think it's an MSI file, which is how you install programs to Windows. So it's, I guarantee you, it won't let you install it if you're not administrator.
Yeah, I do see it. Okay, now it's up here, show in folder, so I'm going to right-click... And then, let's see, the options are install, repair, uninstall, troubleshoot, install with Revo, uninstaller pro, scan with Microsoft Defender, open with, give access to, restore, send to, cut, create.
If it's not an executable, you won't be able to run as an administrator.
What if I install with Revo and install or Pro?
That would be it. That's the one that seemed interesting to me.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. Do you want to allow this app to make changes to your device?
Or? There you go.
Yep.
Yeah, well, Dennis, thank you. Well, I tell you, look, you're there today. Now, guess what?
Educated guess.
Yeah, well, half right. The same thing popped up. Installation could not be open, verify the package exists, that you can access or contact. The other thing I'm going to do is, and see if this may, I'm just going to pick another program and try to download it.
Yep.
And if
I would also check and see if you've got any Windows updates that are pending. I wonder if that package might be cryptographically signed.
Well, typically what I ran into on my new Dell that I got is Windows tends to block installing any other software. And, you know, you usually get a window and you have to click on more and you say, yeah, go ahead and do this. I trust this site and that. And they put up a warning.
Right. Yeah. But he wouldn't even get the MSI to click on in that case.
Oh, yeah. It'll download it. Well, it'll start
just to. Quarantine it?
It'll start to. And then, but it doesn't complete it.
And you'll end up with a stub.
Because you really, you know, it puts it down on that taskbar, but it's not there.
Right.
I see. So it aborts the download.
Yeah. Yeah, because it says, no, I'm not going to allow that on the machine, even though Windows thinks it downloaded and puts it on that.
What browser are you using?
This is Chrome.
Should work.
Yep. Okay.
I don't know. I'm afraid we'd have to be sitting at the machine to see.
No, yeah. That's fine. I understand.
But you're on the right track.
I do see one more thing I'll read to you. At the top of the screen it says, Revo Uninstaller Pro is a monitoring system. Is monitoring system changes. Proceed with the installation as usual. Please do not run any other setup files, programs, or anything else during the installation of the program after you finish
installation. So what it sounds like is that Revo Uninstaller is blocking it until you say yes.
Okay. Well, I'm going to shut everything down, start it up, and watch for any windows that I should have seen before.
Well, that one right there tells me that what it's saying is Revo Uninstaller is blocking the install until you say it's okay.
Okay, but I should have seen something that asked me if it was okay, right?
Isn't that asking you?
No. It just says, do not run any other setup file programs or anything else during the installation of the program. And they even threw an exclamation point in there.
Somebody's saying, though, maybe you're running the SE version of Windows?
That's a version 10.
Okay. Well, there are several flavors of Windows 10.
One yeah, there's of them, Pro, there's Home, and there's SE.
One of them is
just
a
S.
Yeah, S is a version that is for lower power computers that doesn't use applications like LibreOffice in the same way.
You'd have to go into your control panel, click on the system, and that will open up a window, and it'll tell you down a little bit what version of Windows 10 you're running, whether it's Windows Pro, Windows Home, Windows S.
Okay, yes. Yeah, I found it. Thank you. OS name, Microsoft Windows 10 Pro.
Oh, Pro, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you should be all right. I don't know. Honestly, Pat, I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll just start shutting everything down and going back to the basics.
Yeah, and look at the whole screen, and if that other thing pops up, check it.
I think I might have said something, and I just didn't really catch it. So
Thank
you, and I'll get to work, and I'll listen to the after I turn the computer back on.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, we'll see you guys.
Bye-bye. Yeah, one of the issues we run into all the time, it's multifold. Sometimes it's your fault for not reading the screen carefully before you click yes or no.
Right.
Sometimes it's because stuff pops up in weird places. He had a thing up in the upper right, a thing in the lower right. There might have been a thing in the lower left when the download started. So there's just a whole lot to take in when you're looking at the screen, and sometimes we miss something because we're so focused on the fact that we want to install a piece of software.
Right, right.
And we miss what else is going on.
And Windows, it's not just Windows, but there have been an awful lot of pieces of easily downloadable, hey, click here, lots of flashing lights,
right.
And suddenly you get an installer And there have been attempts by the browser manufacturer, by the operating system, to say, whoa, time out, hold up. Do you want to allow this download? Number two, if you download this and try to install it, are you sure you want to install this? Just trying to get people out of that tunnel vision for the installation.
Even on Linux, if I start to install something under Chrome, if I start to download a file under Chrome that ends in .exe or .msi, I get a little pop-up that says, this may harm your computer. Of course, it won't. I can't run it. This may harm your computer. Are you sure you want to download it? You have to say yes for the download to finish.
Yes, you have to approve.
Defender, they're saying, I was just quick looking, and they're saying Defender can, how to open a file blocked by Windows Defender Smart Screen.
Okay.
Oh, so if he stops Windows Defender and then installs the software and then starts Defender again.
I just did a search, you know, on how to... what did I put in?
It's really important to keep yourself protected, and that protection can get in the way of productivity, of actually getting something done, like installing an app that you want to install.
I just typed in how to unblock a program being installed on a Windows 10 machine.
Right.
And boom, a lot of stuff comes up. And because I remember I had that, like I say, that issue with my new computer, that it was... I was trying to drown some software packages that I've done countless times on other machines, and all of a sudden this new machine is saying, no, you can't do that. Well, now it opens up a little window and it says, you click on more, and you can then say, yes, it's okay to keep it.
Okay.
But keep you have it. To click on more, which maybe Pat didn't notice.
Yeah.
Yep.
And keep anyways, and then it puts it down in my download folder.
Right. That makes sense. Windows is just trying to protect you from installing software that
malicious
they don't approve
software.
Of.
Yeah, that tries to sneak in.
Right.
As we've said before, you install a package and other stuff tries to sneak in behind it and get installed too.
That's right. So it is very you know, what they really want you to do is go to the Microsoft Store and only install packages in the Microsoft Store.
Bingo.
And I don't honestly know if LibreOffice is in the Microsoft Store. I doubt it.
Well, the other thing he can use too, though, is Google Docs.
Sure.
If he's using Chrome, he's got a Gmail account, he just open up Google, you know, Docs or spreadsheet, or everything's there too. It's saved up to the cloud.
He's a LibreOffice user. He's got it installed on other machines, he said. So chances are good he wants to try and keep the same feature parity across machines. So I'm confident he's going to get this figured out. He'll let us know what happens.
I am too. And apparently it is in the Microsoft Store.
Uh-huh.
So Pat could just go to the Microsoft Store and download it and all his problems go away.
Interesting.
All right, we are done for the first hour, but do not go away. There's an entire hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe ahead of us. We're going to have Dave Enright. We're going to have Dennis Worster. We're going to have Steve Ray somewhere out in the ether. We're going to have me, Nick Francesco, and we're going to have you. It is 59 minutes after the hour. It is Sound Bites, and we are going to take a break, but we'll be back. So take a little bio break. Enjoy yourself. Relax. Get a beverage of whatever sort makes you happy. And then come back for more Sound Bites right here on the Truly Great, and truly grateful to you because we are solely member supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you on the other side.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Grease Rochester, a public service of the Grease Central School District and official media partner of this year's CGI Rochester International Jazz Festival, Jazz 90.1.
On Instagram at WGMC Jazz 901.
Welcome back to America's longest running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And he's Steve
and he's
Ray.
Steve Ray
in the video chat here, in the video he's in the stream. Video.
We did have Linux. Living Room Jazz by William says, I love my distro. God bless Linux.
Okay.
A lot of people are playing with Linux these days. A lot of people. And it's...
Well, they're getting tired of Windows bricking their machine. Or Windows, Microsoft, I'll broaden it. Microsoft using every user as a beta tester.
That's right.
Back in the day, you had to sign up to be a beta tester.
Well, not just every user, every customer. You are actively paying them.
Oh, you're not Microsoft's customer. I keep reminding you of that. Microsoft's customers are the shareholders.
Yep.
Microsoft is a publicly traded company. Therefore, the customers are the shareholders. We are the product they bring to those customers.
To make more money.
That's how that works. That's economics 101. They don't care about you. They care about their shareholders. And if you have to be the guinea pig to make the shareholders happier,
oh well, oh,
fine. That's fine.
So be it. And you get to pay the price. And, you know, that's why so many of their rollouts, and they've been the subject of ridicule here because everything they try to do either breaks a machine or mucks it up big time, destroys people's data. I mean, you could probably get millions of people that due to updates and everything else have destroyed their machine, or they start using a product and then all of a sudden they walk away from it. And it's like...
Back in the day when you could not schedule an update for Windows, we'd have faculty who didn't use their machine for 4 or 5 days and then came in to teach their laptops, came in to teach a class, opened up the laptop in front of the class, and there's a two-hour download install waiting for them, and they can't say no. What do you do? I've had many frantic calls. Help me.
Yeah, what do I do? What's going on here?
We've said many times, you know, you're in your office for office hours before class. Turn your machine on.
Yeah.
Turn your laptop on and let it update then. But they often don't. And
That makes no sense. Just to even just have it running and turn off the monitor.
Yeah.
What's so hard about that? That way you don't ever have to worry about it. You know, matter of fact, it's less wear and tear on the computer.
That's right.
But if you can get an operating system like Linux and install it on the hardware you already own, and you have more control over what you want to do, and you have the ability to customize it to look and behave the way you like, and it all costs you a total of not even a dime.
Exactly.
You know,
you've already got the hardware.
Or it just costs you your time and learning
time.
Something.
That's fun. That's fun time.
Oh, that is.
You know, the Mac does much the same thing, but with the Mac, you can't just get the operating system. You have to buy the hardware.
That's true.
If you've already got hardware sitting around that you're not using or you use rarely and you want to play with a new operating system, Linux is free. Absolutely 100% free. You can start with a distribution that already exists and just play with that until you get comfortable, and then you can start experimenting, or you can start experimenting from the beginning.
And the thing of it is, though, is there's so many tutorials, YouTube videos, that if you want to install, say, you folks have heard us talk about it, Linux Mint or Linux XFCE.
Right.
You can do a Google search on that, and there are plenty of videos that will walk you through on setting up the basics.
Right.
And it is not hard, folks. And if it's an old machine, so what if you mess it up? You just erase it and start again. No biggie.
And there are a dozen versions of Linux that look like Windows.
Yeah.
So you don't even really have to learn anything terribly new to start with.
No.
But you can make it look just utterly amazing. Utterly amazing. A lot of people, we've talked about the various dash look sites. Many people just change colors, but some people are doing some truly amazing things. I should bring in my Linux laptop next week so you can see what I've done to mine.
Well, I think I'm going to have to install Wine because I want a couple of my software packages are Windows based.
Okay. Right.
And I'm going to have to run those in a Windows emulator program.
Wine is not an emulator. That's what it stands for.
Terminal program. Yeah. Terminal program.
It is an emulator. It just says it isn't. But yeah, Wine is a program that lets you run many, not all, but many Windows programs under Linux. So if you've got an app that only ever runs on Windows, the likelihood that you can run it under Windows is high. All right, let's read another news item while you give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Russia's biggest internet company has embedded code into apps found on mobile devices that allows him back to Russia that allows information about millions of users to be sent to servers located in its home country. The revelation relates to software created by Yandex that permits developers to create apps for devices running both Apple's iOS and Google's Android. Pay attention. This is both iOS and Android. Researcher Zach Edwards first made the discovery regarding Yandex's code as part of an app auditing campaign for Me2B Alliance, which is a nonprofit organization. Okay. Four independent experts ran tests to verify his work, so we know it's true. Yandex has acknowledged that software collects device, network, and IP address information that is stored both in Finland and in Russia, but it calls these data non-personalized and very limited. It added, although theoretically possible, in practice it is extremely hard to identify users based solely on such information collected. Yandex definitely cannot do this. Again, I apologize to every Eastern European on the planet. The revelations come at a critical time for Yandex, often referred to as Russia's Google, which has long attempted to chart an independent path without falling foul of Russian President Vladimir Putin's desire for greater control of the internet. The company said it followed a very strict internal process when dealing with governments. Any requests that failed to comply with all relevant procedural and legal requirements are turned down. But Cher Scarlett, formerly a principal software engineer, I love that name, Cher Scarlett, with two T's. Formerly a principal, frankly, my dear, formerly a principal software engineer with global security at Apple, said once user information was collected on Russia's servers, Yandex could be obliged to submit it to the government under local laws. Right. Other experts said that the metadata of the sort collected by Yandex could be used to identify users. Yandex has software in the form of a software development kit or SDK called AppMetrica. Among the apps with AppMetrica installed are games, messaging apps, location sharing tools, hundreds of virtual private networks, tools designed to allow people to browse the web without being tracked. Yeah, ironically. Seven of the VPNs are made specifically for a Ukrainian audience. Total installs of apps that include the AppMetrica SDK are in the hundreds of millions, according to App Figures, which is an app intelligence group. Ron Wyden, chair of the U.S. Senate's Finance Committee and one of the architects of the U.S. Internet regulation, heavily criticized Google and Apple for not doing enough to secure smartphones from the Yandex software, which has found its way onto 52,000 applications, reaching hundreds of millions of consumers. Senator Wyden added, Apple and Google maintain that their monopoly-like control over their app stores is necessary to keep customers safe. Every day that apps built off Russian Yandex SDK remain in those stores is further proof that the consumer safety they claim to offer is an illusion. Some app developers have started to remove AppMetrica from their apps following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Opera, a popular web browser with a built-in VPN, also said it disabled the SDK as of February 15th in preparation for its full removal. It did not give a reason beyond saying we switched to our own advertising platform. Conversely, more than 2,000 apps have added AppMetrica SDK since the invasion of Ukraine. So are you sure you're safe? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. Just like Jim did from Irondequoit, New York. Hi, Jim. What's up?
Hey, so my computer updated, the Microsoft update, and the next thing I know, it's not a real old computer, but it's a desktop, like maybe 5 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. It just, the hard drive is, I can't get it back up. It happened once before, and I went online and found some solution where you switch the booting to a legacy or something.
Yep.
And it worked. That time it worked, but this time nothing. It's like dead. Is it worthwhile to take it somewhere, have them remove the hard drive and put a new one in and
Hold on a minute. Do you even, when you turn the machine on with the maybe the side of the case off, do you hear the hard drive even spinning up?
You know, I can't tell you that, but I've tried pushing the F1 button to get to that screen and tried all that, and it doesn't work at all. That no longer comes up. Well, it does, I guess, if I do it 3 or 4 times, but I can't tell you if I hear it humming or not. I don't know. If I hear it spinning or not, I don't know.
Yeah, you might. Sometimes you can, turn the machine off, of course. If you take the side of the cover off and undo the 2 screws that is holding the hard drive in.
Yeah.
And you can pull it out and, sort of hold it in your hand and turn it on. And you can feel it.
Yeah, start to spin up.
Spin up.
Yeah. The metal platters on the inside.
Yeah,
you can feel the torque.
But it is a good idea to take it to a reputable dealer and have them take a look at it. It may be a dead component, or it could be that Windows borked installing. So
hard drives die all the time. When we were building machines, I could order a bunch of hard drives. I remember one time we ordered like 10 of them, and 8 out of the 10. We're dead right out of the bag.
Yikes. That's a horrible rate.
Yeah, that's a horrible rate. I wouldn't buy that company.
It was back in the 80s when Western Digital was having some issues.
I was going to say, was it Western Digital?
Yeah, Western Digital. And 8 out of the 10 died right out of the bag.
But a local shop will probably be able to diagnose this relatively quickly and give you your options, and then you'll have a good path to move forward from.
I called one place, and they said if it's single SSD.
Mm-hmm.
What does that stand for? Single
solid state drive. It's a fresher, more modern way to store things. Old hard drives had metal platters that spun around, and you'd use magnetism to write to them and read.
Magnetism.
And the new models just read and write to chips, like on the same way your cell phone stores data.
Very small, very fast, very very fast, and use less electricity and less the same amount of time, frankly.
But he was saying there's a possibility they wouldn't be able to transfer the data from that type of hard drive to a new one.
If it were an SSD and it did not boot at all, it may just simply be dead, yes.
Yeah.
But it is, if your machine is 5 years old, it's highly unlikely it's an SSD.
Oh. But I thought I read it on the side there of a label that shows all the information.
Okay.
Maybe.
Well, it could be.
Now, is it worth it to do that? Because I have another computer. It's just mostly there's music on there that I was trying to save.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
The local shop can help you figure that out.
Exactly. And in any case, getting a new drive in there means that you will have, again, a new machine, even if they can't get any of the data off the old drive. You'll still have a second working machine. You can put your music back on it.
Right.
One other thing you can do, if you're not using that machine right away, you can get these drive enclosures or cables for going from SATA to USB. You can get them on Amazon. They're like $4. What you could do is order one of these. You pull that hard drive out. You hook up this drive to your second machine and boot it up. And if the drive is any good, it's going to see that other drive so you can get your music and that off of it. And for the price of that little cable, you can,
avoid a trip to the shop.
Yeah, and, determine whether, I got to get this hard drive's dead and I need to get a new one. And you can still, use that cable for down the road if you want to pick up another drive. And use it for your backup.
Right.
So that might be another option.
All right. Maybe I'll try doing that and see what that... You called it a what? A SATA? S-A-T-A?
No, SATA. S-A-D-T-A. SATA to USB cable.
S-A-T-A.
SATA. And it's maybe about six, eight inches long.
Depending on the one you get.
Yeah. And it goes from, it hooks right up to your SATA drive, because that's what all the hard drives nowadays are. And it goes from the SATA drive and it converts to USB.
Yeah. They're about, what, 20, 30 bucks?
No, I got...
You said four.
Depends on which one you get.
Okay, or which shop you go to.
Yeah, I got mine for like $6 or $8, I think it was.
Okay. Yeah, I got... I wound up getting like three of them.
Last time I needed one, I was in a hurry, and...
Yeah.
I had to go
so if I'm going to try removing the hard drive, is there anything I should be aware of if I'm going after those two little screws you mentioned?
Yeah, to make sure the machine is turned off.
Fair.
Leave it plugged in, though, because that way when you touch the case, you're grounding yourself.
Okay.
Not the plastic case.
Right.
Some metal in the case.
The metal inside. And you take those two screws out. The hard drive will slide out. Uh-huh. You unconnect the two. Usually it's two connectors, a power and a data connector to the SATA drive on a desktop. Unhook them, and there you go.
All right. Maybe I'll try that.
Give it a shot. Let us know.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yep.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
I will tell you, Dave, I just took, a couple weeks ago, I took about a dozen laptops, took the hard drives out of all of them.
Yeah.
Not one of them had fewer than four screws in it. Not one of them.
Oh, yeah. No, most laptops always. Yeah, they know. Well, because they're being toted around.
No, I get that, but don't tell them two screws if there's four. He should look for all four.
Sometimes the desktops are in these little trays. Well, some of the corporate stuff, they make really easy to chop and swap everything. And that they're held in sometimes just with little pins and spring-loaded things. Mm-hmm. But
unfortunately, every single one I had was made by some sort of...
Screw merchant
who threw in... I've now got two... Well, most it's to some of you, this will make no sense. Film canisters.
What?
I now have two full film canisters of screws.
Old Kodak.
Old Kodak films canisters.
35 millimeter. Okay.
I'm going to have to start 3D printing them because I can't get any more.
With the nice little Rubbermaid lids that they would have.
Right. Right, exactly.
Okay, hold on.
So, yeah, there's, I don't know. Can you still buy film canisters?
I don't know. We used to put, well, because I have been riding bikes forever. We used to put $6.75 worth of quarters.
Sure.
In there. And then when you're out and you need to call home, back in the days before cell phones, you could hit that and call home, or you could go get yourself a burger and a drink while you're figuring out how to mend your flat. But
yeah, right, exactly.
So they're handy.
Apparently, you can buy on Amazon. You can buy 15 of them for $7.
50 cents a piece?
Yeah.
Huh. Who knew?
Who knew? And Prime delivery, you'd get them Tuesday.
Oh, good.
That's important.
What are you two talking about?
Film canisters.
Nerd Easter eggs.
Oh, okay.
Nerd Easter eggs.
Yep, okay.
And Easter is coming.
That's right. And you put the candy in there?
Or I bought one of those little things, the little USB double-edged USB thing.
Oh, yes, that we talked about last week.
I just got it. I haven't put anything on it, so I'm not carrying
Speaking
it with me.
Speaking of purchases, yes, I talked about a USB flash drive that had a USB-A connector on one side and a USB-C connector on the other, and both have access to the same data, so that when you are using your newer computer that only has USB-C connections, you can still get to the data. And if you need to do something like put a boot drive on it that you can boot up one of your older computers with, a live CD or a live installer, then you can do that.
And you were completely accurate. My daughter's already stolen one. My wife has not yet. Yet.
Yeah.
I was going to say, there's the key. Yet.
Exactly.
I told you, you have to saturate the house with them.
I already bought three, and I may buy another three this weekend.
There you go.
Because I'll be needing them. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Don, who is from Pittsford, New York, but apparently currently is in North Carolina enjoying the sunshine. We hate you, Don. What's up?
Well, the sun is shining indeed.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's about 72, 73 degrees.
Please.
Anyway, I feel for you, but I'm sitting.
Yeah.
Something about a computer question?
Yes. My question is, how do I determine if my PC has VPN, virtual private network, loaded on it, and whether or not that is turned on or off, and how do I find it to turn it off if I choose?
Okay. For our listeners, I'm going to give a little bit of background. so that we can all be on the
same
page.
He should come back to Rochester to get the answer.
That's right. We don't answer people down there.
So a VPN is a connection that your computer makes to another computer across the internet. And the internet itself is not necessarily trustworthy. People can see things as they pass along. A virtual private network is a connection that you make where each side agrees to encrypt the traffic, to scramble the data in a way that can be unscrambled at the other end, but in a way that is terribly computationally expensive to figure out while it's in flight between the two points.
Right.
And this is commonly used if you are connecting back to your workplace or if you're connecting to a university or any place where you need to have a trustworthy connection between two points on the internet.
Now, the big issue here, well, first let's answer your question. The easiest way to tell if you're connected to a VPN on your PC, hover your mouse pointer over the network icon on the lower right of your taskbar there.
Down by the clock.
Down by the clock, there's a little network icon. Hover over that, you'll see a little pop-up. If you have a VPN connection, it will show there.
It'll be listed.
Okay, I'm looking at that, and I'm seeing the volume control, the date time stamp, and to the right is a, looks like a file with the numeral 1 in it. Where do I click?
You don't click on anything. If you had a VPN, it would show up there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm. Well, are you pointing to the network icon? I think it's in that same area, so it doesn't matter. I think you got it.
Another thing to know is that a VPN connection is typically a manual connection. It's something that you would have to initiate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you haven't initiated it, chances are good
you don't have one.
Secondarily, I believe there's a built-in VPN piece of software built into Windows, but oftentimes a workplace or somewhere else that you're attempting to connect to will give you software that you are likely to use where you'd need to input some credentials to connect to the VPN, usually a username and a password.
Mm-hmm.
So if you haven't done either of those things or you don't have that software, chances are good that you are not actively connected to a VPN right now.
Okay, my memory is a little bit vague, but I'm using AVG software paid version, and it seems to me, if I recall correctly, that there was a choice that pop-up that came up with regarding VPN. My question is simply that occasionally, but rarely, I watch a television program or want to on the computer with a Spectrum account. I have spent a few hours talking with various representatives of Spectrum, and finally they concluded that I must have a VPN on my PC because that is why they say that I have not been able to access my Spectrum account and watch TV.
That is very possible, and AVG, if you have the professional version, I think it's called AVG Secure. At any rate, there is a VPN in it, so you would need to go into the AVG software and turn that off.
Okay. I may have to try and contact the company to find out how to get that screen up. But anyway.
Well, you should just be able to open up the AVG software, and one of the choices.
Down in the lower right-hand corner tray, right-click on the AVG icon that's in the tray there, and usually they say settings or configure.
Okay, and I choose which, settings or configure?
It's
settings. Try settings, and if it's not in there, it'll be in configure, but you try settings first.
It's usually one or the other.
Okay, good.
It usually doesn't say both. It usually says one or the other.
One of the two of those, yes.
And if that is where it was activated, I presume that it's simply a toggle to turn it on or off?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Terrence.
Thank you. Good luck. Have fun.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Come back to Rochester when it's warm. We're going to take a quick break.
What?
I said we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Dennis Worster, Steve Ray virtually, me, Nick Francesco. And you, it's 29 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Henry.
And I'm still Dennis Worster.
And in 34 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites. Rich Simpson said those USB to SATA cables will work for laptop drives, but I believe will not have enough power to handle a desktop hard drive. That is right. Absolutely true. You can also get the model, which was mine, why mine cost more, that have an auxiliary power cord that plugs into them. So if I am, and in fact, I took about half a dozen laptop drives and another half a dozen full-size hard drives. And the laptop drives work just fine with USB that had power in it. The desktop drives did require that extra power cable in order to run.
There's another device that I have that is cool. It's maybe about 4 inches long. It's plastic. It looks like a bowl.
Okay.
And what it has is it has different pockets in it. You can slide the an old IDE drive down into it, and then connect it to a USB slot, or you could put a SATA drive in it. It also has the workings for micro SD cards and extra USB ports. And I think it cost me, because it was an all-in-one, hard drive all-in-one reader. And I think it maybe cost like $20-25.
Yeah. I had the one that I got is just for SATA, which was a mistake. But you can also buy, even if it's just the cable, with three connectors on the end. IDE, SATA 3, and I forget what the other one is. It doesn't matter. But the point is...
SCSI?
Yeah, it must be SCSI. So the point is you can get those, and those are, again, fairly cheap. But Rich is right. You want something. If you're going to do full-size hard drives, you need one that has an external power cord with it. If you're only doing laptop ones, then the power that comes out of the USB itself is enough.
Right. Yeah. You get, I think, 500 milliamps.
Good point. Yeah.
Or whatever USB. It is. But that, you're absolutely right, Rich. Good point.
That's enough to spin the little motor that spins the hard drive platters, even if you've got a platter drive and not just an SSD. You can make that work.
Right.
And it's a super handy cable to have if you are trying to move between machines or if you're trying to troubleshoot things. It saves so much time and frustration.
Let me finish that. If you want to permanently add a drive, you can also buy, for example, I have a SATA 3 enclosure.
USB. You can get the enclosures that will handle both full height drives and small
half height drives or laptop drives, whatever you've got.
I have one of those.
So my hard drive is bigger than my Raspberry Pi that sits on top of it. It's hysterical to look at. But you can do that easily as well. So there's lots of ways. Often, what died in your computer is not the hard drive.
Right.
Now, hard drives have a mean time between failure of 5 years. So if your laptop is 5 years old, that hard drive may not be the healthiest. But you can still use it as a temporary storage or a backup medium or whatever you want. And in particular, it's less important nowadays because we have so much RAM. But back in the day when you didn't have a lot of RAM, if you had a separate small hard drive to put your swap file on, it made your machine much faster because you didn't interrupt the main drive to swap stuff in and out.
Right.
I used that on the old Frog Pond BBS, and it was great.
In the days of virtual memory, when RAM was so expensive, then this was the next best thing. And it came at a cost of speed, but you know we were willing to wait with time more than we had dollars to try and solve the problem.
My Linux machine has 16 gig of RAM, so my swap space is 32 gig. I've never used any of it, ever. And on the one hand, now I'm wasting 32 gig of my hard drive. On the other hand, that's a terabyte drive, and I've got a 2 terabyte drive in there as well. So I'm not.
Space isn't an issue.
I'm not really worried. although when I was backing up all of those hard drives,
mm-hmm.
at one point I only had 300 gig free on my,
oh my goodness,
2 terabyte drive. I was short of breath.
Yes.
I really was.
The shaking
panic
has
moment.
Only recently
panic
stopped.
Moment.
The day that I legitimately, without those, went over a terabyte and had less than 50% of my storage left.
Right.
It was a traumatic moment.
Yes. I feel that way about my Synology. It's, yeah. You start filling up, you're like, oh, I thought I had a lot of, hey, where'd all the, where's my.
Yeah, I ran into that with, because now I have a separate pie that's for my wife backing up her photos.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
and I took a look at it one moment because I was going to use that as another little, because I figured I could take a little bit. It's a 2 terabyte hard drive.
Sure.
I'll grab a little space off there to also back up some of my stuff.
Is this like when your spouse, you go out to eat and you get the French fries and they say that they're only going to have a couple. And the next thing you know, they've had half the fries. It's like that, but for geeks.
She uploaded so many photos there because of her picture taking for the grave sites. I looked at it, and it was 3/4 of the way full on a 2 terabyte drive.
Looks to me like you're buying another drive for her.
No, I says, no, time to do some house cleaning. She had folders on there that she had worked on over a year ago. The pictures are already up there.
That's the problem, isn't it? When you have so much space, you don't do house cleaning.
Right.
And that's where I said, whoa, no, time out. What about all these? Well, I already did those. Do we need them anymore?
It's like living in a warehouse.
They're gone.
Now you need you need to buy another drive and archive them.
Nope.
Yeah. You say nope until the day comes when your wife says, oh, I need that file back.
No, I don't have to worry about it now because they're going to Amazon Prime.
Oh yeah. They're going to Amazon Prime. As long as they're up there,
that's
you're right. All good.
Once
she's done working for them, but they're archived, and that's exactly what you're supposed to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and as long as you're ready to pay rent on that drive space, then
You're already paying for Amazon Prime because you want the video.
True.
Or because you do free shipping like my wife does for
then
her
business.
Then
it's a value add.
Then it's just free.
Right? Yeah, we get the video.
Yeah, we did it originally for the shipping for her business.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, Prime Video was free for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and the Amazon Photos is free for
it's
us.
All gravy on top.
It's all gravy on top because that's a business expense. We were paying for that.
Right.
Yep.
So yeah. I just did that the other day. I uploaded some 22,000 photos.
My goodness.
Well, I can put them. But see, the thing that is once she has them up linked to Find a Grave, they're there. And
right, they're up there too. Right.
People would have to, and they don't have the rights to delete her photos. They can send her an email and request to have them changed or anything else. And but once they're there, so she doesn't need them anymore.
Right.
It's not like the people are going to move out of the cemetery.
Right.
Once they're there, they're there.
Most of the files that I uploaded were from my father-in-law's hard drive. When he passed, I got his machine. But I just left it in a corner, never did anything with it. So I finally went, like I said, I went and took out all the hard drives so I could recycle the hardware.
That is the thing that I can't stress enough to folks is, you know, documents and all that other stuff can be recreated. The photos
cannot
have to be your number one priority and backing up, and then I'll back up one more time.
Exactly right. And that's the important thing. And you've got to remember, you can't get those photos back. So, yeah, I put all those up. I shared them with my wife and my sister-in-law,
mm-hmm.
his 2 children. And they were thrilled. There's, you know, relatives that died 40 years ago.
Right.
You know, and all of that. So there's just a lot of stuff there that was a beautiful thing for her.
Well, that's
all right.
Nice.
What?
That's nice.
That is nice. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Mark from Greece, New York. Hi, Mark. What's up?
Hi, Nick. How are you?
Peachy. How are you?
I'm peachy also.
There you go.
I just wanted to say, you guys were talking about Avast before, and I'm a big proponent of Avast. I think it's gone way up. I gave up on it a while ago.
Yeah.
About 4 years ago, and I went over to Komodo. But I'm now back to Avast. they've really, really improved the free product, and their paid product is spectacular, too.
Yeah.
What do you like about it?
Well, my first thing I like about it is that I can do a boot time scan.
Okay.
Right.
And nice to be able to check for something when, you know, the computer's not booted.
Right, because for everybody else, if you have a rootkit, that takes over right at boot. So even a regular antivirus will often not find it because it's blocking that. Whereas if you scan at boot before anything else loads, you can catch those and remove them.
Hmm. Okay.
Right. And I haven't found another antivirus that does a boot scan.
Which one?
That I know of.
He hasn't found one
that hasn't. That's the only one I know that has the feature.
Right.
And I also like that it, for as much as there is in there, it's very lightweight.
Okay.
Yep.
And I'm a big proponent of that, paid and free.
Okay.
Yep.
They're spectacular. So, you know, out of all of them, that's one of my favorites now. Again, I think whatever they've done, they've really improved it.
Nice.
Stepped their game up.
Very, very high level. So.
All right.
Oh, by the way, Nick.
Yeah.
I see you like the coffee poster I sent you.
I loved it. Thank you.
I thought it was right up your alley.
It was indeed. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Anytime, my friend.
Very good.
Thanks.
Have a wonderful day.
Yeah.
You too.
Thank you. Have fun. Yeah,
bye-bye. Avast is one of the many antivirus programs that are available.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's available for pretty much everything.
Yeah. We've got some business clients that make use of it.
Yeah. The business version is available for a lot of systems.
Right. And the management tools there are coming along nicely, too, to make sure that all of the machines in the business are up to date and their virus definitions are up to date.
Right.
Set up
scheduled
scans, et cetera. You can do that on all the platforms.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is James from Rochester, New York. Hi, James, what's up?
Oh, yes. I have a Windows Defender that came with my inexpensive laptop. How long does that stay on, or do I have to renew that? It's been a year and a half, and I haven't done anything, and it's still on there.
The good news is you are still, it's still running. You have, Windows Defender is from Microsoft, and it is free, and it runs all the time.
Yeah, because I checked the settings, and it says no action needed. I have the firewalls. Is that all I need for this inexpensive laptop?
Yeah, pretty much. You don't need anything else. Defender is good. It is not great. I wouldn't necessarily use it in a business.
No.
But in a home environment, it's fine.
It's a secondary laptop, and this obviously runs in the S mode. Is that, I know, for the inexpensive laptops, is that S mode more secure than, like, my big Dell?
Theoretically, because you can only load things from the Microsoft Store.
Right.
And that theoretically makes it more secure. In practice, not so much, but theoretically, you can only load things from the Microsoft Store.
I would say that was Microsoft's intent.
Yes.
That was one of the things that they were claiming to be a feature.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. For me, a secondary laptop that I just to look at things on.
Right.
All the firewalls are on. It says no action needed. The only thing I want to do is stop the pop-ups in the lower right-hand corner, which half of them are advertising or pushing for something.
Yeah, I would say you have done a reasonable job with, given what you're intending to do and the tools that you've got, you've applied them in a very reasonable way.
Okay. How often should I run the CCleaner on this secondary laptop?
Generally speaking, you don't need to run it too often. When things seem sluggish, mostly as you load and unload programs, testing them, playing with them, stuff like that, that's when CCleaner is most useful. It doesn't hurt to run it.
Yeah.
But it isn't really necessary once a month or so, maybe.
Yeah, just like I say, I don't do any work on this. It's just to look. It's just look at things or whatever, check this and that.
Right.
Okay, then the Defender, that's good.
Well, yeah, that's
fine. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, James. Have fun.
Okay.
Yeah, the Windows Defender is Microsoft's antivirus program. It's right. It's free. Comes with every Mac, every Windows machine.
Right.
But Windows Defender comes with every Mac, just because the heck with you.
That's an agreement. I would have loved to hear about the boardroom negotiations that allowed to happen there.
Exactly. And videos as well, William says. Yeah, you can.
Now, that being said, if you were a bad guy and you were writing a virus, I think the first thing you would do is make sure your virus knew how to get around Windows Defender.
That's exactly right, because so many machines run it.
Right.
The fact is that that's one of the reasons that for many years we recommended people use some of the lesser known virus programs, because nobody wrote stuff to get around that.
Right.
One of the things I like about ClamAV is that you can also run it in manual mode.
Yes.
So, you know, every once in a while, you just run ClamAV on a system and see if it's finding anything that got around the other stuff.
Yeah.
William says videos as well. I assume that is talking about Amazon photos. Yes, but you only get 5 gig. Of video storage.
By default, unless you want to pay for more.
Unless you're paying for more, right. You only get 5 gig, but you get unlimited pictures.
Do they downsample those the way Google does on some of their free tiers? Okay.
They do not. Like I was saying, I put up a bunch of pictures of folks who have not been around ever, for the last 25 years. People were thrilled to see them. Photos from his childhood. There was just a lot of really pretty cool stuff.
I want to think that in the future people will be able to use facial recognition, especially as people age over time in different photos, and that they'll draw links between the people so that you can jump.
Well, I haven't tested that yet on Amazon because, it takes a couple of days after you upload them for that to kick in.
Right.
But I have done that on Google. And if, for example, it finds pictures of my wife from when we were married 40 years ago, from her childhood.
Wow.
And now, and I think that's scary, but very cool when it's working for you.
Well, yeah. And if it gets reasonable in a family, that would be an interesting way to just build up a family tree.
Yeah.
Just by photos.
Yep. Yep.
Kind of interesting.
Yep.
Of course, it depends on everything being accurate, but.
Everything being accurate, and you have to label people.
Right.
So, it'll find my face, but if I say search Nick and I haven't labeled me as Nick,
right.
It won't find me.
Right. Well, and it may have trouble if you have a beard in one and don't.
Been since I was like 15. So, right. Yeah. All right. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Frank from Webster, New York. What's up, Frank?
How you doing? I'm hoping to have green light someday.
Yep.
Me too.
Closer. Right. But, I'm in the process of finishing insulating my attic, and I'm on a slab, so the cable has to come through the attic and down to a wall.
Right.
Could I pre-run the cable so that I don't have to get up there when it's all full of insulation for them? I mean, do you know what kind of fiber cable they use?
I do not. That is something you would have to ask them, I'm afraid.
Contact them. Yeah,
I'm sorry. Okay. I don't know. Mine just came in through a wall on my second floor.
Now, that being said, they do run a fiber into the house.
Right.
Then they give you a box that's about the size of a deck of playing cards, and it has a connection for the fiber, and it has a connection for a power, and it's an adapter that turns it into regular computer network cable.
Right. I saw the video online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing you could do is run the network cable in the wall in advance, and as long as you've got electricity up in the attic, then you could have that little deck of cards adapter up there. Now it would be kind of a pain in the butt if you call in for support and they say you need to turn that off and on again. But if you wanted to do something in advance, that would be something you could do.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'd rather run it down through the wall and have it where the current internet comes in.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately DSL, but...
Well, hey, you got to start somewhere.
Got to start somewhere. All right, thank you.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
You're
welcome. Yeah, it can be tough. I would also, see if you can take a Greenlight sales rep to lunch and see what you can learn from them. And I bet if they know it, they'll share it.
Yeah, I'm sure they would answer that question without a problem.
But there's single mode, there's multi-mode, there's different diameters, there's a whole bunch of factors.
I've never honestly paid much attention to what that cable is. They installed it,
right?
Gave me my ONT, the optical network terminal, which is the modem.
The deck of cards thing.
Deck of cards thing. And walked away. I dust it once in a while, and it runs.
The little light blinks, and you smile at it, and pat it nicely, and then proceed on your day.
Yep. In the last, 5 years, however long I've had Greenlight,
right.
It's gone out a total of twice. Once because somebody out on the street was digging up a sewage line and broke the cable. Hardly Greenlight's fault.
Nope. Not their fault.
And the other was an outage in the neighborhood. Again, not their fault.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, we've seen that too, especially in companies where there's construction going on. And we call it the fiber-seeking backhoe.
It seems
to grab and crunch the fiber and break the optical connection and then take down an entire building. So it can be an annoying day for everybody involved.
Yeah. Yeah, Living Room Jazz by William again says, many of our family members are reluctant to use social media. So I store pictures in a half dozen other places that aren't online or virtual. Yeah, I get that.
Okay.
And
just make sure people know where to find it.
And Steve says their box said Corning when they installed his. But again, it tells you who made the cable, not what kind of cable it is.
Right. Yeah, no, it's true. But there are so many different kinds of fiber that that's something that's easy to get wrong. Whereas if you are running Category 6 networking cable, that is all created to a standard. In general, those are much more likely to behave nicely, even if you don't pick the exact right flavor. So that's why I made the recommendation.
Oh, did you see the announcement this week?
What's that?
Which announcement?
Orbi now comes out with, you know, how they had the Orbi 5?
Okay.
Orbi 6 is out.
Nice.
And supposedly it is a lot stronger as far as the Wi-Fi. It in a home will go a lot farther as far as distance, great speeds.
Now tell everybody what an Orbi is.
Orbi is
the word and we didn't define it.
When you're getting your say Greenlight or even Spectrum, you know, if you've just using your own modem, you want to check it connected to a router. A router hands out the addresses. Think of it like a traffic cop. And your internet comes to the router and it sits there and passes out unique addresses so it knows where each PC or laptop or, you know, tablet is in the house, even your own phone.
So all your devices can use the same single internet connection.
Right. But it keeps them separate. And you can also, you know, all share the same point going out to the internet. So one person could be watching TV. Another person could be texting their friends back and forth, you know, over the internet and back and forth. But Orbi just came out with I have the Orbi 50, and it's a great modem, great coverage. It even came with a satellite that I put upstairs. Because like Nick, I've got an old house, and it's got the Faraday cage effect in it. So I've got the satellite upstairs, which broadcasts the wireless, which is better for my internet and for the TV. So they just announced the 6. And that's supposed to be a lot stronger.
Yeah, it's a Wi-Fi 6 system, 6 gigabits. Get a router plus one satellite. $800 currently, $100 off, $700.
And is this the Netgear?
This is Netgear, the Orbi.
Neat.
It looks like a pretty neat. Thing. I suppose how fast your system is depends on what radio bands you have in your phone or your laptop or whatever.
Right.
There's no miracle here, but if you've got the right Wi-Fi, you can do 6 gigabit per second speed. So that's not half bad. All right, we are done for another week. I want to thank Dave Enright. I want to thank Steve Ray, who was so kind as to get us up and running on StreamYard. We'll see what happens next week. I think I'm going to bring a real laptop next week. Thank you, Steve. I want to thank Dennis Worster, who was wonderful to come in while Steve is one step ahead of the law. I think somebody's breaking down your door, Steve. You better run. Dennis Worcester came in, and we'll see if Steve eludes them for next week or if we have Dennis back. But I want to thank everybody. We'll see you in just 166 hours.